through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number two of Tom, Jake, and Stacy, and I want to continue with what we were just talking about there before as far as what changes should be made, just not even with the Seahawks as a team, but specifically around Russell Wilson. Because the one thing, you know, as you were comparing the playoff games there the last 2 years, Jake, you got to remember, in this game with Green Bay, using Marshawn Lynch to run three times in a row in one series, I agree, that's a bad idea. That's a bad use of Russell Wilson. Why just use his skills at the end of a game as opposed to the beginning too, especially when you're deficient in your running game? Now, if you have Chris Carson, a healthy Chris Carson, do you still want to modify their offense so that Russell Wilson, I mean, how many more passing attempts are we talking about during a game? I mean, if Schottenheimer is really holding him back, to what extent is he?
I don't think Schottenheimer is holding him back. I think that's the narrative that people need to get away from. I think Brian Schottenheimer is growing as an offensive coordinator, and they are continuing to get better and better as they go along. Just like we talked about at the top of the show, they made a huge jump in 2018 from pass attempts to 2019. Their offensive production went from being middle of the road. They had a nice, you know, they had the number one rush offense, but they were middle of the road overall as an offense. They went into top 10 in almost every statistical category. So I don't think Brian Schottenheimer is the main person that's holding them back. I think they got fooled in the sense that they went and looked at the Green Bay Packers and said, okay, they are 23rd, 24th in rush defense. We can go up there, we can line up, and we're going to try and bully the Green Bay Packers. What they should have done is they should have said, okay, they struggle in the run game, but we are still going to rely on Russell Wilson to set that up, to be that game breaker, the guy who gets the chains moving, who scrambles and, you know, makes some, you know, 10-yard rushes for first downs, and then that's going to soften up that defense. Then we can start running the football. That's the approach that they took in the second half, and they actually ended up being able to run the football a little bit. But in the first half, they actually said, we're going to line up, we're going to get in heavy personnel, and we're going to try and smash mouth run the football down Green Bay's throat, and it didn't work.
But philosophically, that Green Bay game, and really each of the last three games, are outliers because you didn't have the main piece of your offense other than Russell, which
is
Chris Carson.
That is correct.
I think people would argue then that you should have known going into it you wouldn't be able to do the same thing.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, so, we agree on this.
Yes, we do agree on this. Mm-hmm. So let's just say for the last three games when they had Marshawn and they were deficient, they didn't have the other main piece of their offense, they should have modified it then. Agreed across the board.
Absolutely.
But we're having this conversation about Russell's prime and going into next year. I feel like the offense, as long as the personnel is healthy, they've reached a nice balance where they don't really need to modify the approach or the philosophy at all.
I think the strength of what this team is that they're getting more and more balanced. And Stacey, I think you have a statistic that shows that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 54% of plays this year were pass plays as opposed to 48% last year.
So that to me is growth. That's huge growth. So I think that you're right in that standpoint. I think that they can use Russell Wilson more to make their offense a little bit more dynamic at the beginning of games and allow Chris Carson to still get his carries and his touches, but not make it the focal point to start the game. We are going to establish the line of scrimmage. We are going to insert our will with Chris Carson, you know, running right down their throat. I think that they don't abandon the run game, but have a little bit of a different approach as they continue to grow in year three of this offense. And Russell has shown that this year in particular, that he is ready, more than capable of being able to do that and make this offense still very, very effective and more dynamic, I think.
I think that's why the big conversation that I'm seeing happen, the big debate I'm seeing, is whether or not Pete Carroll is the right coach. I think he is. I think Pete Carroll is a phenomenal coach, and I think that the things he does well are the things that are harder to find with head coaches, and the things that you will have a harder time replacing.
Culture building.
Exactly. And the mentality he shares with Russell Wilson, they sound the same. I mean, they have a lot of the same core beliefs there. I think that some fans want to see whether it's more innovation, whether it's just giving the ball to Russell Wilson more. And they worry that that goes against Pete Carroll's philosophy, and that because of that, he'll never do it.
You know, you mentioned in the break something interesting. If Sean McVay had a crack at Russell Wilson instead of Goff, do you think that Russell Wilson could have masked the Rams' offensive problems with Gurley?
Yes.
Wow.
He is that. I mean, that's the thing. He is that dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, what was the conversation about the Rams? Well, their offensive line just isn't nearly as good. Well, they were better than the Seattle Seahawks offensive line this year.
Yeah.
And look at what Russell's doing with that. I mean, yeah, he would have. It's amazing what Russell can do in an offense like that. But to me, I look at it, and Stacey, the point that you bring up, I think Pete Carroll right now is at an interesting crossroads, just like Bill Belichick was with Tom Brady, specifically in that stretch from 07 to probably 13, 14, where they transitioned from a defensive-centric team with a running game, and Tom Brady being a great quarterback but more of a game manager and not as a slight whatsoever, but take care of the football. To 07, they open everything up. They are giving Tom Brady elite weapons across the board, and they go and compete at that level. I think that they're at that crossroads right now where they should be going in that direction offensively, and it'll be interesting to see if Pete is willing to do that or not and give Russell Wilson all of the tools possible to make that happen and to not hold him back just because of your previous philosophies that you've had as a coach. I think that's what makes great coaches. They look at their roster and they continue to grow and adapt.
Okay.
And know how to build and strengthen that roster.
When that offense gets into a groove in the second halves of games and they're just moving the chains left and right, it's Lockett, it's Turner, it's Metcalf, even Josh Gordon, right? When they get the ball for about 3 minutes, and you know for that 3 minutes, you have no doubt that they're going to make it probably 60 yards, and they're either going to kick a field goal or they're going to get into the end zone. Is there something about the second half of games, just the nature of football games, that makes that easier for them? Or is it just that they've turned Russell loose and said, okay, just go do your thing? Because if it were that easy, then they would do it in the first half, I would think. Well, I mean, why would they mess around with a running game at all if they thought, you know what? Russell's good enough. Russell and his receivers are good enough to just dink and dunk their way down the field, no matter where it is in the game.
Well, Pete Carroll, after the season was over and his end of year press conference, was asked about that. Was asked about the slow starts in the first half, and he said, "I don't really have an answer for you. That's something that we're continuing to try and dive into and figure out."
But I can't accept that as a fan.
I understand.
Who's asking that question? I can't accept that he's only looking into that now. That doesn't make any sense.
And they probably have been looking into that in the future. But
for years.
But as Stacey said, he has a clear-cut philosophy in terms of how he thinks football should be run and how he wants the game to go and be dictated. And I think Danny O'Neill wrote an interesting article on 710sports.com about midway through the season, was that Pete Carroll was coaching the way that he's coaching this Seahawks team in 2019 is how he's coaching it at the dream version, meaning that they've got a great defense, they've got a great running game,
yeah,
and coaching it to that style rather than looking at it and saying, no, we don't have a great defense and we've got an amazing quarterback and we need to, you know, call the game and manage the game differently. I think those are the things that you have to look at if you're Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks in 2019 and 2020 going forward. Is looking at that first half, looking at how you're managing games with the roster that you currently have and trying to move forward in that direction. So
it's just disturbing to think that he's the only one in this town who doesn't realize that his defense isn't elite.
No,
and
that
he can't coach it that way.
I think that he probably thought, I think he clearly sounded disappointed and thought that they would be better than they were and was frustrated with the lack of production. But I think going back to the conversation just about how whether or not he'll change and what that looks like, earlier this year when the Seahawks played the Rams, he was asked, hey, what do you think now about Sean McVay heading into another year with LA? And you always ask them about like the opposing coach or their system. You just look for random quotes for things. And the first thing he said was he knows himself. And I think it shows the things that value most to Pete Carroll. And one of the things he values most is knowing yourself, knowing your core beliefs about your team and the way that you like to move forward. And I think that for a coach who has succeeded with those beliefs and has seen the most extended success with this team with those beliefs, it's hard to challenge them because you wonder, well, what happens if I get off track? And all of a sudden, we don't have a philosophy we're buying into because I keep changing it. And I think we maybe aren't giving enough credit to how hard it is to do that, but I think it needs to be done.
Well, age has to factor in there, too, because you're talking about him getting that question, what if I get off track? If he were 48 years old, that would be a very interesting question to have to ask yourself, what if I get off track? Because I might never get hired again. But Pete, ostensibly being near the end, does he really have to worry about that?
Well, I was thinking off track is more what if you lose sight of
what your core values are?
Yeah, that there's a power that you feel in knowing exactly who you want to be as a team.
Yeah, and I can totally understand that. And the difference to me is that Pete Carroll, culture-wise, has his philosophy. That's never going to change, and no one in Seattle should ever want that to change. Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll is an unbelievable coach. Has a tremendous culture here in Seattle and with this organization. Just from a philosophy standpoint, in terms of game management, I think that's where you have to evolve and adapt. And Bill Belichick, just like Pete Carroll, known for being one of the greatest defensive minds in football, and adapted the way that he thought of games and adapted it to the strengths of his team for a you know, extended period of time. So I think it's possible, and it has to be a discussion that's on the table.
Four down territory.
This is Four Down Territory.
With Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
Why is Clowney a must to re-sign for the Seahawks?
One of the things that we talked about at the top of the show was about defensive struggles and where they particularly struggled. And the last thing that I said was blue chip talent. And Jadeveon Clowney is a blue chip talent. And to me, he was your biggest playmaker on defense last year. You lose Clowney and you are trying to replace that. And I don't think you can adequately replace that with a couple different guys in free agency. I think Clowney is a guy that you can build around. He's 26 years old. He has that game-changing playmaking ability. He's got that toughness. He's got that, you know, bravado on the field where he can change the temperature of the game. We saw him do that before this season. And so to me, he's a must sign to this team in order to give them a nice building block and also another clear-cut blue chip type of player.
Have you guys seen the movie Blue Chips?
No.
You never seen it? Have you ever heard of
it? I like blue chips.
You mean like tortilla chips?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the blue corn ones.
Yeah, really good.
They are good.
No, I've never seen that movie, Tom.
Never?
Uh-uh.
Hey, Curtis, have you seen Blue Chips?
I've heard of it. I have not seen it.
Really? I think you more than anybody in this room would really appreciate it.
Have you had blue chips?
Yes, many times.
Is it a poker movie? What is it about?
No, it's about basketball.
Oh, okay.
It's about recruiting. It's got Shaq in it.
It's got Penny Hardaway.
Penny Hardaway.
Oh, no way.
Nick Nolte. It's got Bobby Hurley in it.
Okay.
I don't like Bobby Hurley.
Neither do I, but he's in it. He's playing for Indiana, too. Second down. It's about recruiting and shadiness and all that stuff. It's really
nice.
Good.
Okay. I'll check that out.
No, you won't.
Yes, I will.
No, you won't.
That stuff fascinates me.
It's an interesting look back because the culture has completely changed.
Jake doesn't need to watch it. He lived it.
That's right.
That's true.
Stacy.
Tom.
Will Rashad Penny and Chris Carson be ready by training camp?
I think the safe answer that I'm personally going with right now, my personal expectation, is that they won't be ready by the start of training camp.
Ugh.
But I think there's a lot more optimism on this team and this coaching staff for Chris Carson to have a quicker recovery. Right here in this cut is Pete Carroll talking about him.
Real optimistic, more so about Chris, because Chris doesn't have to do any rehab right now. He's not having surgery and all that. He just got to get through it and stay off it for a while. He's a fantastic workout warrior, so he'll come running back.
Pete Carroll initially compared Chris Carson's injury, this is the night he was injured, to Lano Hill. Immediately said it's kind of like the injury Lano Hill had. That was a fractured hip. I don't believe Carson will have surgery. I think Pete said that he won't. And so I would look at that timeline for fans out there looking to see how long he'll come back. Just kind of track where Lano Hill was last year, where he missed part of the offseason, then was able to get back in there. I think with Penny, it's a much more extensive recovery because he had essentially reconstructive surgery for his knee and then now has 6 or 7 months ahead of him to come back from that. That said, Carroll said he's ahead of schedule. They're feeling pretty good about it. They also really like what they saw about Travis Homer, so I think as a whole they feel good about this running back room.
Bust?
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 Penny? No.
Bust?
Give him another year.
Remember, I told you.
Give him another year.
Give him another year. You serious? Remember,
yeah.
2 months ago, I said I was off the Penny thing. I was off his case forever.
Give him to the trade deadline.
And then right when you were about to give up on him, he shows you that was the wrong move. And then he goes and breaks your heart. Just when you start, Penny's coming back. He's playing well. Maybe he's found his groove.
Yep.
We're starting to see the potential there of the first-round pick.
And then
torn ACL.
Torn ACL.
And then Stacy told me he's not going to play at all.
That's not what I said.
He's a fuck.
I think it's going to take him a full offseason to get back from this.
Third down. How does DK Metcalf improve in year two? He can't. He's perfect.
That's what people are saying. I mean, DK Metcalf can do no wrong. I think DK had an unbelievable rookie year. And he was a guy from the very beginning, as soon as I saw him at rookie minicamp, that I said, okay, this guy is going to contribute to this team in a big way. I think year two, he's going to be light years ahead of where he was this year. One, he's going to have a tremendous amount more confidence. Two, I think he can still really improve his route running ability. I think DK is still very raw in that aspect. He continued to get better every single game. But I think DK, and knowing him, he's going to be motivated more so than any other player to perfect his craft so that he can come back and not just be a nice 1-2 combination with Tyler Lockett. But I think his eye is becoming one of the best elite receivers in the game. And I think that he has that ability to do that. And he's got to show that he can run every single route in the playbook. And once he shows that, they open it up more and more every single week. But if he can show and give Brian Schottenheimer the confidence that he can run every single route, he's going to be dynamic, because that's when you could really start using him all across the field, in the slot, outside, as a true mismatch situation like Julio Jones.
He's another one, though, whose numbers and performance is contingent on the number of times they end up passing the ball, whatever that may be. Fourth down. What simple aspect of the Seahawks defense was lacking this year?
Now, it's very simple. To me, they lacked team speed on defense. They lacked the explosiveness to the football. When the ball was either handed off to the running back or you had a receiver in space, there was not team speed, three or four guys flying around to the ball. And I think that that's something that it was definitely missing in this Seattle Seahawks defense. They lacked speed overall, and they lacked physicality. They lacked attitude. They lacked presence. Just like we were talking about the Tennessee Titans, when a guy hits you and he hits you with violence and physicality, there are three or four other guys on that defense that are there, congratulating him, slapping him on the head, and they are almost showboating to that standpoint. There really was no attitude on this defense, and that was something that was disappointing to me, because you look at defenses in the past, and when they play like that, that means they're having fun. That means they feel like they're invincible and they're playing at a high level. And that attitude is felt to the other sideline. I can guarantee you that. You can go into a game, and at the start of the game, the first five plays, and that defense is flying around. They're hitting. They're celebrating. They're making it known how hard they're hitting you. you know that you're about to be in it for a long 60 minutes, and I think that's something they got to get back to.
So clarify, do they just not have the player to do it? I mean, Quandre Diggs was kind of supposed to be that guy. Marquise Blair also, right?
Yes. They do have pieces. They've got Quandre Diggs is a guy like that. This defense has shown in this scheme of Pete Carroll that just the right personnel, the right attitude can make all the difference. And I think Quandre Diggs is a guy like that. Marquise Blair is a guy like that. We've seen Bobby Wagner be that person before Clowney. But you got to have it all across the board, all across the board. And yeah. I think that's something they really got to try and capture and get back to.
We said it from the beginning of the year, is that this team really on defense, they lacked a viciousness. They lacked that intimidate. Look, the intimidation factor that the 2013 and 14 Seahawks had, that carried over. It didn't just happen in the first couple plays of
For
the game.
Sure.
It happened there, but it carried over so that the other team that you were about to face was thinking about it and game planning for it all week.
Do you remember?
That's yet another thing to have to account for.
You remember during the season, gosh, it feels like forever ago, but Sam Darnold on Monday Night Football, they had him mic'd up, and the poor guy, they let out there and said, man, I'm seeing ghosts out there, right?
Yeah.
You remember that? Well, that's what that Seahawk defense did. With all of those things that you just said, Tom, I saw on tape Aaron Rodgers in that prime let go of or not find wide open receivers. Why? Because he was seeing ghosts, because he felt like that defense, because of their presence, was getting him to him faster, that the windows were shorter, when in reality there were guys that were open. And his mind was just sped up. And that's this type of stuff that you want your defense to have, that presence and to have that feel and that fear factor. And so that's something hopefully that they can get back to and recapture in 2020. And that's something that they have to do.
World Series managers are being fired two at a time. Who's next? The halftime show coming up, 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show, it's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Yesterday, after we left, Alex Cora was dismissed by the Boston Red Sox. Or excuse me, it was a parting of ways, a mutual parting of ways.
A mutual parting?
Yeah.
Tom, a mutual parting?
It was not a mutual
That's how
parting.
They decided to word it?
That's how it was explained to me.
That's ridiculous.
Bashful.
Why do we have to do that? Why can't it just be, all right, we caught this guy cheating. We're letting him
go. You broke up with him.
He was fired. Now, here's one thing that doesn't make sense to me. There's a lot of things about this story that doesn't make sense. But the way the Red Sox are framing it, they're pleading with their fans to not judge us until the investigation is done. But we just fired our manager. Like, those two things don't work together.
Right. We didn't cheat, unlike that cheating cheater that we fired.
Yeah, exactly. But don't judge us yet. Not all the evidence is in, but we just fired this guy. God, mighty.
It makes no sense.
None at
all.
Do
they think that their fans are that stupid?
Maybe. That's why I say mutually parted. Like, what do we think this is? Like, do people really believe that?
I don't know.
Yeah, Alex Cora is just like, you know what? I'm not feeling the Boston Red Sox anymore, so... Yeah, I mean,
in
this stuff's coming out.
This
is just coming out anyway, so
you know,
I've been wanting to go on
a vacation.
Stacey, you asked Salk before when we had him on about punishment for Alex Cora, and I think his answer was something along the lines of, well, he's already lost his job, and that's terrible, but unless he's banned or suspended or whatever, how is it any different from any other manager who's ever lost his job?
Right. Well, and I don't... Well, in that he wasn't, like, struggling, or he wouldn't have lost his job otherwise had this never come out.
Yeah, but I mean,
but I
look,
think part of it, too, is that A.J. Hinch...
If the league doesn't suspend him, somebody else will hire him in a second.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing. A.J. Hinch was fired after the suspension. So you can't just say, oh, well, he's already fired, so that'll do it. They're going to hand down some kind of suspension.
It's got to come a year after... Well...
I think.
Oh, I'm Cora, anticipating. I thought we were anticipating punishment to be announced like any day.
Yeah.
For Cora?
Yeah. For Cora.
I think, from Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the case.
Here's
and
the
I would
thing,
anticipate
though.
It being a year or two in terms of the suspension. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a 2-year suspension.
Does Major League Baseball know the full extent of all this stuff yet, though?
I think the investigation of the Red Sox is still ongoing. I think they've concluded their Astros investigation.
Hmm.
But he was part of the Astros. So even then, I think they're probably just trying to figure out.
He was part of the Astros and the Red Sox.
So they already know how guilty he is or what his culpability is with the Houston investigation that they had. Now it's just, okay, what do we tack on top of that?
Right. There's enough to fire him as the Red Sox organization have done just based on what he did with the Astros.
Yes.
Is what we're saying. But now we do need to figure out what he did with the Red Sox because there's another World Series title that needs to be dealt with. We're talking about two, not just the one in 2017.
Is the assumption people have that the Red Sox cheated during that title too?
Yeah.
Yes, that is the assumption.
Okay, I'm making sure we're all on the same page here. No, but me too. I totally think that.
Don't you guys want to hear from some players on this though, too?
Absolutely.
But
yes.
They have a...
I want a tell-all book.
They have a gag order right now.
Yes.
With all players and coaches in Major League Baseball, every single one of them not allowed to publicly comment.
If Rob Manfred somehow succeeds in sweeping most of this under the rug.
No way it gets swept under the rug.
Well,
it's already out from under the rug. The rug was taken away. Now it's just the bare floor.
No, it isn't, though.
Yes,
because
it is.
There's a gag order.
You're going to put a newspaper on top of it and pretend it's not there. I know there's a gag order, but it's still coming out. You have to publish the report or publish your findings and let people know what it is. And I think just eventually it's going to come out. I don't know. You have to wait until some of those careers are done, but you can't tell me. You cannot tell me right now there's not going to be a movie about it or some kind of docu-series, one book. It's all
You can't put a gag order on the entire league for forever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's only going to be to the extent of the Red Sox. Once that Red Sox investigation is over, I think that's over and done with, right? I mean, unless it comes out to find out that you've got even more and more organizations that are doing this. So hopefully, if I'm Rob Manfred, I'm hopeful that it just ends there. Mm-hmm. It ends with the Astros, it ends with the Boston Red Sox, and that they can try and do damage control and move forward with this.
That's why I think they'll tie it so closely to Alex Cora, because you don't want to make it look like it's an institutional problem. You want to make it look like it's a single person problem.
Listen to the wording you're using. It's sad. Make it look like.
That's what leagues are. They're PR machines.
I know that, Stacey. It just pisses me off, quite frankly, that we follow up dishonesty with more dishonesty.
And that's what their job is doing.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I understand that. And I don't like it either, but that's the way that they're going to treat this. I don't think that they're going to open it up to all other clubs around Major League Baseball and sit here and go really digging and investigating into every club. That's not what they want. They want this to go away.
I want more players to have the guts to come out and say what happened. That's what I want.
It could happen.
I want it to be on the players. This whole thing was player-driven. I want somebody to own up to it.
I just don't. It would be from a lower-level player on the team.
Yeah.
It would not come from one of the star players of the organization. There's too much of a bond, a brotherhood, especially amongst those guys. They don't want to admit to the world that they were cheating. I don't think that you're going to get that until far, far long, removed from this situation.
Yeah, you're not going to get it until people have nothing to lose.
All right, what's next here? Luke Kuechly retires at 28. What? 8-year career, calls it quits. He was actually on with SportsCenter yesterday, and he was emotional.
You know, there's only one way to play this game since I was a little kid is to play fast and play physical and play strong. And at this point, I don't know if I'm able to do that anymore. And that's the part that is the most difficult is I still want to play, but I don't think it's the right decision. So I thought about it for a long time, and I think now is an opportunity for me to step away with what's going on here. I think we've got a really good linebacker room. I think Shaq and those guys are going to step and do a tremendous job.
They won't be as good without you, though, Luke.
No, they certainly won't.
Let's face it. To me, even though his career has ended in the middle of its prime, I think he's still a first ballot Hall of Famer. He and Bobby Wagner are the two best linebackers of this decade. How is he not?
I agree with that. I mean, you look at it and say, okay, obviously this guy, his career was cut short because of an early retirement.
Kenny Easley is only 8 years. With a bunch of injuries. Yeah, so, he didn't get in.
And I think Luke can absolutely get in, will get in, Bobby will get in with the careers that they have had. And he is a game changer. And for the Carolina Panthers right now, Matt Rhule, head coach Matt Rhule, you've got an interesting situation right now because you are in true rebuild mode. Cam Newton's most likely not going to be your quarterback. The captain and star of your defense and Luke Kuechly's gone. I mean, you're trying to build around Christian McCaffrey and Shaq Thompson at this point. So it's going to be an interesting challenge for them. But Luke Kuechly, the other thing that you have to remember is it's not just injuries. It was head injuries.
Mm-hmm. Concussions.
Concussions that he was dealing with throughout his career. And I think that that's something that he looked at and said, look, I've made $68, $67 million in my career. My health long-term is the most important thing to me. And any point as a football player that you start having those thoughts in your head, it's probably time to walk away because you're just not as fully committed to the everyday grind or the physicality that you once were. And so I believe it's probably in your best interest at that point to walk away. And I applaud Luke Kuechly for doing so.
This is all conjecture, but I have to think that maybe this was spurred to by another medical professional saying this isn't good for you anymore, because it sounds like a decision he does not want to make.
Yeah,
and he doesn't seem like he seems like such a competitor and someone who would have had to consider this for a long time and to consider it very seriously. And I think, again, this is me guessing, but I feel like in those cases with those guys, it takes someone else saying, hey, you need to, just so you know, this is a problem, and then they make that tough decision. But
no, I'm with you. I mean, was he just sitting there on the couch one day and said, oh, I don't know about this?
I think this is a guy that just made up his mind, like, I can't do this. I think this is probably a conversation that's been going on for a while. And
I mean,
it finally reached a point where he felt like my future is on the line.
And anything can happen to any one of us at any time. But if I'm in his shoes and I'm thinking, man, I've got this concussion history, I'd be worried about what's waiting for me down the line, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
With all that we know right now.
Yeah, of course.
That I could be in a situation where I end up losing my mind at some point and not knowing who I am, or all the other awful horror stories we've heard.
I mean, they're all traumatic brain injuries. That's what a concussion is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's got to be in the back of your mind. And if you know you can prevent one or two or three more of those happening in your career, then, yeah, I think it's a smart point, with everything that he's accomplished and the money that he's made, to walk away from the game. And so I think that you're probably going to see more and more of that happen with some of these higher level players that are playing this brutal physical positions like linebacker.
Which Mariner changed his name? What? We'll talk about that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
All right, in just a second, we're going to talk about Marshawn and his next line of clothing. His career as a haberdasher. But first, we have kind of a disturbing story coming out of
Penn State. So, this is a story, I didn't actually hear about it until today, which is shocking, just considering the history of that program and this kind of story normally being something that garners a lot of attention. So a former Penn State football player named Isaiah Humphries has filed a federal lawsuit against Coach James Franklin and a former teammate, Damian Barber. And he's alleging that Damian Barber and a couple other players subjected him to pretty awful hazing. I'm not going to get into the details of it on air, but it is some awful stuff. And he says that the coaches kind of looked the other way.
You could say it's sexual in nature.
It's very sexualized hazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would classify it as not even hazing. It would be sexual abuse.
Assault, maybe.
Yeah. So Penn State did a separate investigation about this, and he was actually at the school, this student, in 2018, left in late 2018. There was an investigation in May of 2019. So Penn State didn't move forward with charges. They didn't find enough evidence to where they felt like it was appropriate to move forward with charges. They forwarded all of that to the district attorney, who kind of came to the same conclusion. Obviously, this student still says, no, this really happened. And the student's lawyer, or the athlete's lawyer, says that there was an anonymous tip that clued Penn State in on the harassment that did not come from his client.
So this person is not looking for publicity just for the heck of it.
I mean, I don't know. I think
that at least is what
yes.
they want you to think.
Yeah. And I think that this is hazing anywhere is something that when I say hazing of this nature, I don't mean like, oh, we
sent you on a scavenger hunt.
Yeah, no. I don't mean like tough, we're yelling at you hazing. Yeah. I mean hazing that crosses a line.
Yeah. And this is really hard because in a football locker room and a football culture, there are a couple different degrees of that. If it is a couple bad eggs that are, and what I mean by that is a couple, you know, bad players mm-hmm. on that roster that are going, you know, and doing this stuff on their own amongst themselves. And unfortunately, the underclassmen in this situation that are being taken advantage of don't feel like they have a voice or don't feel like they can make their, you know, this situation known to the team. That's unfortunate, and that's something that cannot happen. If it is a institutionalized thing within this culture of the Penn State football program and everybody's protecting that, then that's an even bigger, more horrific issue. Both are bad, but you get what I'm saying here. It could be an isolated incident between a couple individuals versus the entire football program. That is the culture, and everybody is protecting that culture. Like what ended up happening with the Jerry Sandusky situation, that to me is very disturbing. And again,
that's why I'm a little surprised, Jake, that it got passed along from one group to the next. Penn State investigated it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have enough findings to pursue. Passed it along to the DA, which was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
They decided not to pursue.
And we don't know what their findings were.
Right. And look, people do make things up. We've seen that. Also, whether it's lack of evidence or whatever. But, man, how shocking a story would it be if after all this time,
right,
after everything we knew about Penn State with Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno, if that was the culture again?
And that's what this student is alleging. The first, which is the reason that the kind of thing people are picking out of this headline, is that the participants reference Jerry Sandusky in their alleged harassment of the student by saying, quote, I am going to Sandusky you, which is just beyond inappropriate. And then he's also saying that the coaching staff knew about it, looked the other way, and he also alleges that they unfairly scrutinized his play after he reported the harassment.
Yeah, and that's the type of stuff that you're getting into the weeds as to, unfortunately, what has happened here is that you're getting a determination by the school and by the DA of lack of evidence,
yeah,
right? And that doesn't give you any, to me, that doesn't satisfy me in any situation, because lack of evidence just means that you don't have proof one way or the other. So it really just becomes a he said, she said mm-hmm. type of situation. And that's disturbing, given the history of that program.
Marshawn Lynch, is he selling these shirts? It's his Beast Mode brand, so I guess he is. He's got a new shirt out, says, take care of your chicken. The C in chicken is like a little sense
man,
sign.
This man knows how to make money.
He really did. Now, would you wear one of these? Why not?
Why not? You know, I mean, you take care of your chicken. I tell you this, Beast Mode shirts, they are very comfortable.
Let me ask you this question.
I like how they wear.
Does Marshawn and the phrases that he gets famous for, are those phrases already, or is he making them up?
I think that he...
He has a unique way of saying things.
That's vernacular that is used, absolutely.
Did somebody ever say, I'm about that action boss before him?
I mean, yeah, maybe, but it's the point is the delivery, and it's the stage and the platform
I understand all that. I'm wondering if
he's... I don't think he's making up words.
But is he making up cool phrases? Like, is he that much...
Yeah, he's
smarter or gifted than I even thought.
Yes, he is. He's coining them. He's making them a thing. And I think he also recognizes the situation, right? I don't think Marshawn Lynch got up on that podium to the media and said, hey, I got this grand scheme. I'm gonna help my fellow players out across the league, give advice, financial advice, take care of your mentals, take care of your, you know, physical and emotional well-being. While at the same time, I'm setting up my T-shirt that I'm going to sell by saying, hey, you know, take care of your chicken.
I think
he's saying stuff from the heart and then recognizes that it's resonating with the national audience and is capitalizing on those things.
Yeah, that doesn't bother
that
me.
That, to me, is very, very smart.
I want to ask one more question, though, because he hasn't spent any paychecks, right?
To our knowledge.
Game checks.
Any game checks. From what we heard a few years back, that he was saving all of it.
He lives on his endorsements. For athletes that don't have endorsements, what are they supposed to do?
Live off your game check?
That's really easy for him to say.
Yeah, it is easy, but he saved it, he invested it right, and then he's been able to build up that wealth.
The key is the investing.
But I think, too, I think with that message, it's an important one for young athletes because you get your greatest earning potential when you're like 24 years old. If I got the bulk of, not the money I would earn in my life, but if I got huge paychecks for me when I was 24, I would not have spent them wisely because you aren't realizing that I need to save it. That's normal for a lot of young people. But I think that there's just this kind of precautionary note about hey, even if you're getting your game checks and you don't have endorsements, just don't blow through your money. You could only have 1 year in this league.
All right, save your money, kids. That's the lesson. We still didn't get to the Mariner who changed his name. We'll do that. Plus, we'll go around the NFL next. 710 ESPN Seattle.